We've come to the desert in California to visit with Mary Lee Robb, who is originally from Chicago.
Right.
And so it comes full. I send hello to you from your friends in Chicago.
Oh, thank you.
And from your friends who listened to you when you were so much a part of the Gildersleeve broadcast.
Those were wonderful days. They were just absolutely wonderful days.
You played Marjorie Forrester, and you were the only member of the Gildersleeve household who grew during the course of the show. I mean, your character,
right?
You got older, a little bit older, you got married, you had a family,
right.
All of this on the show, where the others, you know, Gildy never did get remarried,
no.
Or married, I guess.
Right.
And Leroy, I was always an incorrigible Leroy.
I think, at the time, I wasn't so happy about it, frankly. I didn't want to see her get married, you know, I kind of wanted the same thing. I was a little afraid that, the character would, you know, would go off into the sunset, and that was that. But it was amazing. They really did go on for a long time. When we did the marriage, Richard Crenna, who was played my husband.
Bronco.
Bronco, And he was, we dressed it. It was the first time that we ever did anything like it, and we dressed the wedding. What we mean by dress the wedding. They got me a wedding dress. We did it all on the show, and it was done in costume, and very rarely did you do anything like that.
In front of a studio audience.
So, of course, they all adored it, and we were all very, I mean, the flowers and everything, so it was very cute. It was a cute idea.
Now, but later, when Bronco and Marjorie had children, you didn't re-simulate that.
Oh, no, thanks. No, that would have been going just a little bit too far, I'm afraid.
Too much for art's sake.
Right. But we did have some awfully cute children, and they had a big contest. Kraft was our sponsor, and there was a big Name the Babies contest, so we had to go through all of that, so that was kind of fun, too.
How did you get the role of Marjorie on that broadcast?
I'm a little like, who was it, Shirley MacLaine, who... When she got her chance, somebody broke a leg on Broadway, and she replaced someone. Well, Louise Erickson, who was one of the, I think the third Marjorie.
Lorene Tuttle,
and Louise Erickson, and then myself. Mm-hmm. And so Louise was doing a play and was doing something else that day, and something came up, and she could not get back for the dress rehearsal. And I was one of those little people who was in what they called a background noise. You stood in the, you know, blah, 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 talking, you know, in a scene. And the time came for the rehearsal, and I mean, they were sitting there. We had everybody waiting, and I, whether it was traffic or something like that, she couldn't get back. And so I said, well, I'll read. You know, for it, I'll time it for you if you want, because they had the orchestra. See, we had full orchestra and everything, and wonderful musicians. Perry Botkin, who was the great guitarist who had been with Bing Crosby, was also, and wonderful musicians. So they were all waiting. So we did the show, and we did it. And so then something came up. I don't know what happened, and she couldn't get back. So all of a sudden, I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, here I am, the little background noise suddenly being pushed in this thing. They said, and, of course, Walter Dentley, who was so wonderful, he said, now, don't be worried. And Una Merkel, who was a terrific actress, was playing on the show with us at the time, so they were going over it with me. All of a sudden, about 5 minutes before we went on, Louise came in. And it was just wonderful. So she had something it had transpired that she was not able to get there. And then I think what happened was I think she went on to New York. And so when the time came then, I, having done that, it was a great step up, you know, for me to do it. So I was able to get the job then in the fall.
Just because you had been considered and at the post, but you never got off.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, it was just a funny thing. And then I was doing, after that I did some Burns and Allen. I played the little girl next door. Again, Richard Crenna was my boyfriend. He was boyfriend to more women, I tell you, than anybody else around. He was terrific.
Well, he was also on Armis Brooks. Yeah, he was the perennial teenager on radio.
Right. And there's another young man, Gil Stratton, who has been out here and was a very fine, and is a very fine actor, and also a successful sports announcer, I think on...
one of the L.A. stations.
Yeah, on the L.A. stations. And he would come in and out. But basically, Dick was always, at least in my time on the show. I don't know who else was on it before that.
Well, what other radio things had you done?
Well, my first show was Lum and Abner, and I had two lines. I think I had two. I said, "I do, and don't cry, Papa." Those were that was my great break in radio.
So you learn those lines, you never forgot them, though, right?
Oh, I'll never forget them. Of course, you know, it's just like the first time you do anything. And that was my break. They said, "Well, come on in, we've got a part." And I think, as a matter of fact, I got a call not so long ago from someone down south, who, a darling man, who called up, and there were some scripts lost and some shows lost, or they're not around. And one of them was this series that this particular group that I was on, and they were calling for information. So it's been a whole, it's been a most interesting thing. But that was where I started. Then I did, I did the Railroad Hour with Gordon McRae. And who was a dear, dear man, and did some of those shows, and did Red Rider, which was a little series of, like, a cowboy series.
You weren't the love interest of Little Beaver.
No, I let's see, This Is Your FBI. Uh-huh. And then my two series that I worked on a lot was mostly The Gildersleeve, and then some with the Burns and Allen when it was in radio. And then when, of course, it went into television, when then they chose to get different. There are very few of us were on it. I can't remember. I don't think Walter was on the TV series.
On the TV? Yeah.
Was he?
Willard.
Willard was on it.
Was on the TV. Yeah. No, Walter.
Walter.
Walter had gone.
I think Lillian.
Walter Tetley never did any television as any of the characters he created on radio.
I think some of it's a sad thing, because some of us, the wonderful creation of radio, simply by the thought of the audience, to see the personality, you know. But when the time came for it to be on, in a television situation, they just either were a little older, or they just didn't fit the character.
Yeah.
The voices weren't the way they wanted
That's
them.
Correct. Well, now let's see. You say you were from Chicago, and was it in Chicago that the acting bug bit you, as they say?
Well, I took, my dad was with NBC in Chicago, and so I was sort of always around, you know, show business, that part of it. And I took drama at Mundelein College as a little girl. In fact, my dad was one who discovered Mercedes McCambridge when she was when she was at Mundelein. Wonderful actress.
Yes.
And she was part of a group. They had Sister Mary Leola, who was head of the drama, I think, department, had a verse-speaking choir, which was very unique at that particular time. And so that's where he found Mercedes. Mercedes, we always called her that. And so I took it. I started there, and then I came out here. When we moved out here to Los Angeles in 1939 as a little girl, so grew up in Westwood. And so that was, from then on, it was, I took it, did a lot of stuff in high school. So it was always kind of, that was what I thought I was going to do. And then eventually my father died, and I started on a more of a career. I was going to college starting to college, and I chose then to go into radio and get, kind of working and doing things.
And that was mostly out here then?
Oh, yeah, it was always in Los Angeles, not in Chicago.
Did you have to pound the pavement between CBS and NBC and the others?
Oh, I'll tell you, we really did. That's why I said I think that it was a wonderful man who gave me my first break, as a matter of fact, on Gildersleeve, simply because I was back and forth, and but it was all at that time, everything was very centralized. I mean, it was, there on Vine Street, so you went from CBS to Mutual to NBC. It wasn't and the agencies were all around there, so it wasn't a tough thing to do. But I don't know, they were very pleasant, and all seemed like wonderful, it was a great fun. I've always been interested in show business, and in fact, used to stand. We finished Gildersleeve sometimes, I can't remember, but it seemed to me there was a rehearsal, and I'd go back in and stand in line to see Crosby in those days. That was when he was still at NBC, and just to see some of these great performers. So I was very much stage struck.
You mean a performer on the network had to stand in line with the rest of the people to
well,
see Bing Crosby?
Yeah, really. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I may have gotten in a little earlier, but I did stand in line. And they didn't know. I mean, what? I don't. That was a great thing about radio, that you could have sort of an anonymous life, and it was fun, and you just went in and did what you did, and you could leave it and go home. You don't have that same thing today in television. I mean, I'm sure it's a lovely situation or the theater, but there is that being able to remove that coat of mm-hmm. the theater and walk away from it. And the people in it were so wonderful. Oh, we were talking about it. We did a little thing for a group called Spurdvac, and they did recreated Gildersleeve. Mm-hmm. And Shirley was on it, Shirley Mitchell, who you've said mm-hmm. you've interviewed. And it was as though time had stood still. I mean, I had not worked with them. I hadn't seen them. And we had some situations come up that were just so much fun. And it was just like yesterday. I mean, it was like we came in that door, and it was like you and we were all sitting here again. And it was all those years ago. It was a very miraculous time. And people were very fond of each other. And they were... We had fun. We'd have picnics, or Dick Peavy.
Dick LeGrand.
Dick LeGrand mm-hmm. had a wonderful boat, and we'd go out and we'd have parties on the boat or mm-hmm. something. It was more like a family. They talk about those. I think now on a long situation thing, they may get that rapport, but we had that. You know, it was just a very mm-hmm. remarkable. On a motion picture, you don't hear that. You make the picture, and then you leave, and you maybe don't see each other ever, you know, for years and years.
Well, in a movie, it might be 3 months.
That's
or
right.
6 months, maybe.
Yeah.
On a television series, that could be
mm-hmm,
a couple
long.
Of years mm-hmm. or longer, maybe. On radio, it was the norm to run 8 years, 10, 12.
Yeah, it was incredible.
You know, look at Gildersleeve started from 41, mm-hmm. went all the way to 58. Mm-hmm. With almost the same cast. Now, there's something I wanted to ask you about. You were there. You came in around 48, I think, mm-hmm. on the Gildersleeve show. So when you came in, it was Hal Perry.
That's
who
right.
was Gildy.
Right.
And then in 50, it's when Willard Waterman came over. What was the reaction of the cast to the change and then of the listening audience to the change?
Well, Willard is a lovely man, another just a very warm, a gentleman. And the show looked like it was not going to go on. And then it seemed that they suddenly called Walter and I. They said, would you come in? We're going to do a little testing. And we started in September, and that was that. I mean, it was the most unusual situation, particularly because Willard... And Hal, their voices were very corresponding. Mm-hmm. If you've ever noticed, a lot of times they would sort of almost... It was difficult because their voices were very similar mm-hmm. in many ways. I mean, now, in looks, Willard was a much taller, much larger man. But I think the voices, Willard always said, at least the last time we were talking about it, that it, at one time it was kind of a hindrance because there was the same mm-hmm. timbre in the voice. And so when he came on, it was just incredible. There were a few letters, you know, from people mm-hmm. saying what happened or where is he or what's gone on. But it was much less than one would have thought. Maybe it was because it went off and then it went on again and there was a little summer off.
There was a summer in between.
But it was... And he was very pleasant and a good actor. He was a mm-hmm. very good actor, had good timing, you know, and had lots of experience. So this was almost like just putting on another coat that was really quite familiar.
Yet if you listen to the two shows, if you were to listen to the last Hal Perry Gildersleeve show and the first Waterman Gildersleeve show, there's some subtle differences mm-hmm. Between the two voices. The laugh was a little different. But really, for all purposes, it was
and as
the same
as it
kind
turned
of guy.
Out, it worked well because Willard was very good in the role. I mean, mm-hmm. Particularly for television, I think too mm-hmm. that he was very mm-hmm. good, and it's different too because Hal originated that role,
mm-hmm.
and it was his role. So that, as you say, there is a little difference. But for all intents and purposes, it was a very easy transition, mm-hmm. much easier than it could have been, you know, where people suddenly went, oh, no, we won't accept mm-hmm. that at all. I think they loved the show, and everybody else was around it. You know, the same people were still locked into the characters.
It was a situation comedy before. Those shows on radio were just called comedy shows. They were never referred to as situation comedies. The television created situation comedies because they mm-hmm. had to have some name for the genre. But mm-hmm. It was just a comedy show. It was a comedy show with a real warmth to it. And I think I think you can attribute a lot of it to the writers and to the material that they had. Because there was warmth in each show, yet there was some great comedy in there and some of the crazy things that
Well, it was the first spinoff, too. Mm-hmm. I think that was the original spinoff of any mm-hmm. show. He had come off of Fibber McGee.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
then they started that show. And it was... So I can't tell you what a family feeling it was. I think many people have said that about all their own shows that they've been on, mm-hmm. you know. I'm sure you talked to any of the gang from Marmis Brooks or any of them. But we did have a very... it was a very professional group. I was very fortunate to be among these people because the timing was great, the quality of the work, the care that we did, and because when I came on it, we did two shows live. You see, we came in and recorded, and then sent those. You know, that went on back to Chicago, New York, and then we did the 8:30, which was in the local. So those were the days before the tapes. And
one for the West Coast.
One for the West Coast, as they used to say. Uh-huh. And then we'd go in on Monday morning and listen to the show from the week before. So there was a lot of quality control on it. I mean, it was not haphazard that it was a good show. You know, it was.
They made a recording of it, and you went in and listened to it.
Oh yes.
And
we critiqued it.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. To see how it went, how the timing went, mm-hmm. you know, and. On the various things, what worked and didn't work. They were very, very careful. They were very critical of the work to see that it came up to that high standard.
Well, that's why that show lasted so long.
Right. And we had great sponsors, and Kraft was our sponsor for all those years, to my mm-hmm. knowledge. And they were very... it was just a whole thing. It was just a very nice relationship for me. I loved it. And I got... When I was... In my personal life, I was married in the 50s, and so my daughter was born in July, and I was pregnant and did the show and had her in July and went back on in September. So that was radio. You could do things like
that's
that.
That's right.
You know,
so well, to television, they make you
they
stand
do it,
behind
that's
the
right.
furniture. You know?
Right, right. Yeah, I did a little show that had never... did much of that came off, but I remember doing the same thing, putting on a large size 16, standing behind a table to try and to shoot from the waist up.
What kind of rehearsal did you have to deal with on the Gildersleeve show? In other words, from the beginning of to prepare for this week's broadcast.
Well, as I say, we went in on Monday and rehearsed in the Monday morning, and then on Wednesday we went in and. We read it over, and then on Wednesdays, I think we went in and did the show, did a rehearsal. Then at 1 o'clock, we did a dress.
Mm-hmm.
Then about an hour before the show, maybe, or a little longer, we'd go back in and do a cutting session, because by this time, they could see what jokes or what humor was going to work mm-hmm. and what wasn't. And then we went back in and got ready and went to a dressing room, got ready and went out and did the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, it was, I loved it. I mean, if you think about it today, doing them live like that, but there's a certain magic to the liveness of it. I think that's why people loved live television.
Well, you're keyed up
mm-hmm.
for it, and
mm-hmm.
the adrenaline is
mm-hmm.
flowing. And
yeah,
someone told me that once I think it was Jim Jordan, rest his wonderful soul.
Right.
Jim Jordan said, when they would do the Fibber McGee and Molly shows live, they rarely made a mistake. Once they started to record them, to tape them, and they knew that they could cut and edit and do all of that stuff, they made mistakes all the time. And it was just that it wasn't the same kind of tension involved with this whole thing.
Yeah, I could believe that. There weren't many, you're right. I hadn't mm-hmm. thought about that, but there were not a lot of mistakes made or... But again, these people are worth the great, you know, some of these, that was their talent, some of them, that they were able to, you know, do that wonderful timing. And these had been career comedians, mm-hmm. you know, Marion and Jim
yes.
always had great talent. The Gail Gordon, who was, you know, was on their shows and on ours.
He was Mr. Bullard, I think.
Yeah, and Mayor LaTrivia. And they were really fine actors and fine talent. So that it was you. It sounds like, oh my golly, you're going on to do something mm-hmm. like that. Another one was George Burns, who I've learned timing from more than anybody else. Who had the great, great sense of timing, and his you know wonderful wife Gracie, who was
yes, mm-hmm.
who was so adored and. These were people who were, again, professionals. They had just simply come into a different, milieu. That it was just the same mm-hmm. thing. They just moved in. They moved that talent into another area, so that the only time it ever happened to me. One time, something happened, and I lost it. I lost a page in my script.
Ooh.
And I looked up, and it was my week, you know. And I was doing one of those Marjories where she used to babble and blah blah, you know. And I thought, I just thought, I'm going to die right now. And I could feel the perspiration just moving down my body. And fortunately, Dick was standing next to me, Dick Grenna. And I just started looking at his page, and we went through it until I finally found where my page came in. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, all this. But that was the only time. And I must say, I had nightmares over that. If ever I was going to have a nightmare, that was what it was about, was that night where the pages were lifted, you know, and there was nothing there, and you're standing there talking to people.
Did you described earlier the show that you dressed for the wedding,
mm-hmm.
the wedding show between you and Branko. How did the listening audience react to that wedding on the Gildersleeve program?
Well, I think they were very responsive to all the things we did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they
mm-hmm.
because it was a kind of a family show, they liked it. And as a matter of fact, we were fortunate enough to do a The Look magazine covered it, which was kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to a little Episcopal church in Hollywood and did, you know, simulated
oh, you
the whole thing.
Set up some pictures.
And set up the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a thrill. And because I don't think it had much been done, you know, at that particular time. I don't think it was it's not like it was in the olden days, but nevertheless, it was just a different kind of thing. It was a new mm-hmm. way of promotion for the show.
Well, sometime after that, some proper time after that, then Marjorie and Branko became parents, and you had twins.
Right?
And there was a whole big to-do about that on the show.
Oh,
a long
yes.
sequence of
oh, yes.
things, wasn't it?
Uh-huh. And as I said, there was a contest that they mm-hmm. named the children, you know, and that went on and on and on, and it was all kind of fun.
Did they read it? Did they finally name the children?
Yes, remember? And don't ask me.
Oh, okay. Well, we won't bother to ask.
No, I wish I could say I remember. I mean, that was fun.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the other people on the show? Now, you said Dick LeGrand had a yacht.
Yeah,
The yeah. last person I would think they would have a boat would be Mr. Peavy.
I know.
You know?
He was a very interesting kind of an outdoor person, which one would not have thought, you
mm-hmm.
know? The same mm-hmm. thing. I think Lillian, of course, Lillian Randolph, who I absolutely adored, was
Birdie
with us, and we used to have the best time. We'd all, you know, we'd sit around and we'd all go in her dressing room and talk. And we'd always kind of, we went to her dressing room and we'd sit there and have the best time and chat and met some very interesting people. But she was the kindest
mm-hmm.
woman
mm-hmm.
and just so much fun and would tell us stories about her early days. And, you know, that was a lot of that going on. And we had some great, great talent on the show. K-Star was one of the singer was one of Gildersleeve's romances, and Martha Scott, lovely, mm-hmm, lovely lady, mm-hmm. was on for a while, and Una, as I said, and then of course Shirley Mitchell,
yes.
And I was trying to think, let me think about some of the others. I think I was closer to the gals, you know. I think
it was a gentle show.
Yes, it was.
And it was it didn't every laugh didn't have to be a boffo knee slapper.
No, that's
it was
right.
Just a gentle, and it had some very nice, some real warmth on that program from time to time. Once in a while, especially Hal Perry, I think he would sing.
Right.
He would sing. I think Willard.
No, I don't
sang
think
at all.
I don't remember that.
Birdie sang.
Yes, Birdie had a wonderful voice.
Absolutely, I know she did on the Easter program. She would sing a hymn or something.
I remember one time she did His Eyes on the Sparrow.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Oh, which I adored that song. I remember crying on that. Mm-hmm. I can still remember that.
Mm-hmm. Did you also do a short stint on a Penny Singleton series?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. That's right, I did.
Yeah,
isn't that
it was
funny?
Just like
how
a summer replacement or something,
right,
wasn't it?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, we were hoping for more. I don't really think I was much of us. No, it was, I don't remember even there was a summer replacement. Maybe it turned out to be, but they had great hopes for it. Yeah. But I can't think of the little girl. Sheila Benson? No, Sheila
James.
Sheila James. Played the sister on it, who is now.
You were the two daughters of the widowed Penny Singleton.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Without Dagwood Bumstead, it couldn't work.
Well, I think it was really kind of interesting, too, because, I mean, I was older, and my mm-hmm. voice worked, you know, yeah. and so I was mm-hmm. running around in pinafores and flats. But it was a cute show. I think you're right. I don't think it just didn't fly after that. I think they saw her in that role.
It was early women's lib, actually, because she was widowed and she was trying to make it on her own and all of that. And that was way before anybody would expect a woman to try to do that in one of these situations.
I think maybe today it would have more, it was just maybe a little before its time. It had good writers and good writing. And a good director, as I recall, I can't think of his name, but I had worked for him before. And there's an awful lot of good shows out there that haven't made it, you know?
Oh, sure. That's right.
I don't know. She's still hopefully around because she's
I think so, yeah. I think so. Well, I'm glad you're around. And
me too.
I appreciate you inviting us to stop by and reminisce about the
your part. Well, it's great.
Now you
know where the radio people are. They're all down in Palm Springs or Palm Desert, aren't they? They're all over.
It's nice to come to Southern California.
Oh, it's nice to have you here.
Especially because it gives me the opportunity to thank you on behalf of all of those people who listened out there. And enjoyed what you did.
Thank you so much. That's our charming.
Thank you very much, Mary Lee Robb.